We're continuing Megillat Esther with the commentary of the Duvna Magid. And where we left off was on the verse that it was the seventh day the king's heart was satiated with wine. And he called in his seven eunuchs to bring in Vashti. And we posed the question that why is the Megillah telling us this whole story? Why is it telling us that when he got fully drunk he wanted Vashti? Why is it telling us that she refused and he killed her? What's it doing here? The purpose of the Megillah is to understand the greatness of the decree, the great threat that we were under, and to understand the great miracle. So what do I care, part of Persian history, that Ahasuerus killed his first wife? Why is that important to us? Why do we have to know how she died? And we began with saying that this is here to teach us a great lesson. And the lesson is a lesson that applies throughout our lives and in many, many situations that face Am Yisrael. And that is that when Hashem does great things for Am Yisrael, He very often does it from within the trouble. Remember we discussed the pasuk, Umimena yivashea, etzarai leYaakov. It is a time of danger, it's a problematic time. Umimena, and from that danger itself will grow out the redemption. Meaning a normal king, when he tries to fix things, so there's the problem, and then he brings in the solution. A person is ill, so he takes medication. Something else is what's going to cure it. Hashem doesn't work that way. Hashem makes the problem be the source of the solution. Umimena yivashea. Very often we look at the problem and we say, how could it fix itself? The answer is, it can be the solution, the problem itself. That's the way Hashem works. And that's what Hashem is teaching us in the story. So in order to understand this, we have to begin with the quote, the Medrash that says, on the words, Bayamim ahem, it was in those days. And the Medrash says, this is one of those places where the angels up above were sending in notes to Hashem. And they were saying, Master of the world, your temple was destroyed, and this wicked one, Ahasuerus, is sitting and making parties? God said to them, well, give him days corresponding to days. And the Medrash says, this is explaining to us, based on the verse in Nehemiah, that the Jews were working on Shabbos. The Jews who had ascended to Israel were doing business on Shabbos. And Rabbi Chelbo says, woe to such days. As God said, let him have a party, corresponding to the desecration of Shabbos that the Jews have been performing. So the question is, okay, here we're taught that because in those days we were desecrating Shabbos, that's why Ahasuerus made us that decree, that Haman got away with making a decree to annihilate the Jewish people. That's what God's saying. The days of the decree correspond to the days of desecrating Shabbos. But the question is, so then how did we get out of it? What did we do right? If we sinned and we deserved the decree, so then how was the decree annulled? And here he started explaining that there are two levels of relationship between Am Yisrael and Hashem. One is when we're great, when we live up to our responsibilities, and then we shine, and that's what God says in the Song of Songs, you're so beautiful, my beloved. God says, they are a nation that stands alone. You don't have to look at any other nation, just look at them, and you see how great they are. That's one level. Sometimes we do live up to our duties. Then there's a second level. And that is when we don't live up to our duties. When there are things that are not right. And then Hashem's love for us is when Hashem says, let's compare. Okay, they're not where they should be. But let's compare them to the other nations. And then Hashem says, well, compared to everyone else, they're great. So that's level two. That's a lower level. And then Hashem says, okay, I'll give them blessing because you know what? They're not so bad after all. And we have this concept that I don't know of any other source that it's discussed. Meaning the Gra says concept that's almost similar, but it's not this. I don't know of another place that it spells it out like this. That there are two ways Hashem views us. And he brings us psukim in Tanakh that allude to this concept. We all know the pasuk, the beloved says to her loved one, she says, my beloved, let's go out to the field and we'll go to sleep in the villages and wake up in the vineyards. The sages say, what does it mean, let's go sleep in the villages, in the kfarim? That the Jewish people say to God, go look at the kofrim. Go look at everyone else that denies you. Compare us to them. What does it mean, nashkim ala kramim, and then we'll awaken in the vineyard? That's a reference to the Jewish people. We find in the prophet in Isaiah, God says, ki kerem Hashem tzvakot bet Yisrael. My vineyard is the people of Israel. So throughout Tanakh, Chazal often teach us that when it talks about a vineyard, it's talking about the Jewish people. So what are we saying? That's this concept, says the Magen Midovna. That sometimes we say, so we're not perfect, God, but look at them, look around, we're still okay. Where else do we see this concept? In Hosea. Hosea was so fed up with us that when God said to him, the Jews keep sinning, Hosea said, fine, let's pick another nation. Enough with them. And then God says, okay, you go take a prostitute, Hosea. Have kids with her. And she's not going to be faithful with you. Do you still love those kids? Do you still love her? Do you want to divorce her, Hosea? You don't want to divorce her, but she hasn't been faithful. And as much as you begged her to be faithful, you don't even know if they're your kids. But you do love them, right? So what are you telling me, my people Israel? So they're not living up to what I like of them. You're telling me to choose another nation? They're my children. So in the prophet of Hosea, we're not doing too good at that time in history. And the Navi says, Hashem says about us, Kanavim b'midbar matzati Yisrael. I found the Jewish people to be like grapes in the desert. Meaning, you try to grow grapes in the desert, they're not going to grow too good. But you know what? When you're traveling in the desert, they're going to taste just fine. Whatever they do produce is still good, because you're out in the desert. That's what God says about us at that time. They're like grapes in the desert. They may be a little shriveled, they may not be the tastiest grapes, but when you're out in the desert, they're great. Says the Magen Midovna, that's this concept all over again. Towards the end of the period of the first temple, God is about to destroy the temple and exile us, and God says, well, you know what? They're still out there in the desert compared to everyone else, okay? So they're sour grapes in the desert. They're still okay. And that's what the prophet Jeremiah says in the famous verse, Matzachin Bamidbar. The Jewish people found chen. Chen is when you don't have beauty. Yofi is beauty. Chen is when there's no beauty. Finds favor. Yeah, we found favor. Even though technically we didn't live up to it, but we're better than everyone else because we were in the Midbar. We were in the desert. We accepted the Torah. And that's what the Navi says. My love for you nonetheless is eternal because you agreed to accept my Torah. And that's what the Torah repeatedly says. I offered the Torah to every nation. No one wanted it but you. Why did Hashem have to offer it to the other nations? Because this is part of our relationship with Hashem. It's like a person's traveling and he comes to a place where there are many inns. So then he walks into the inn and he doesn't get everything he wants. So he says, I don't have to stay here. There are 50 hotels down the block. What do I have to stay here for? But if a person has been traveling and he comes to a place where there's nowhere to stay. And finally he goes through the city looking for a house that has a mezuzah. At the very end of the city he finds a Chabad house. He walks in and he says, God bless the Rebbe. I came out here, I needed a place to spend the night, and oh, what a great thing that you guys are out here for me. What happens if things aren't exactly the way he wants it? The shower isn't exactly warm, the food isn't exactly hot, nothing's exactly the way he wants it? He doesn't say a word. He says, thank God you guys are here. And that's this level of relationship with us. That Hashem, so to speak, says, I've tried everyone else. And it doesn't work. No one else wants my Torah. And the idea was that Hashem can always come back to this level where Hashem says, well, you're better than everyone else because no one else wanted me. No one else wanted my Torah. And that's what Hashem says, that although the nations did not, although you sinned with the Egel, I still prefer you to the nations because I don't have much of a choice. The nations aren't interested. And it doesn't sound so great, but that's why Hashem says, I want you to do better than that. This isn't the level we should be at. The nations in the future will say, so what if we didn't accept the Torah? The Jews accepted the Torah and they didn't keep the Torah. The Medrash says they're going to make that claim. They're going to say, you can't hold it against us, so we didn't accept it, but they didn't keep it. They weren't honest the way you wanted them to be. They didn't do everything the way you wanted. God's going to answer and say, God's going to say, well, it's like I'd be in the desert and I needed a place to stay. I can't leave them because I don't have a better choice. Where am I going to go? Meaning there's an aspect where Hashem, so to speak, says, I don't have anywhere else to go. You're my people. And this concept, the truth is, this concept is mentioned already in the Torah, where Hashem says, because you're my chosen people, I'm not going to let you get away with things. At some point, I will punish you because it's not like I have a second choice. It's not like I'm going to choose another nation. So if you sin, I'm not going to let you get away with it.
Which is a brilliant refutation of the whole Christian concept of Hashem leading.
Right. You see it throughout. You see it in the Torah, you see it in the prophets. Right. Now, in the future, we have a promise that Hashem says He'll give us a purer heart, a newer spirit, and then we will be more whole. And we won't need this comparison that God will say, okay, they're not so great, but compared to everyone else, they're fine. And that's what the prophet says in Zechariah. Roni v'simchi bat Zion, rejoice and be happy, daughter of Zion. Ki hineni ba v'shachanti b'tochech nu'um Hashem. For I will come and dwell in your midst, says God. And many nations will follow Hashem, and I will rest in your midst, and you will know that God sent me to you. So the question is, why does the verse say twice, I will rest in your midst? It began by saying, rejoice, for I will rest in your midst. Many nations will follow Hashem, and I will rest in your midst. And secondly, what does it mean, you will know that God sent me to you? Obviously, the prophet was sent by God. Did we doubt that Zechariah was sent by God? So he says, we can understand this based on the following mashal. There was a king who was traveling, and he was traveling with his men, and as they're traveling, a tremendous snowstorm started brewing. And they're stuck. They can't go back. They can't go forward. They're stuck next to a small village. So the king goes to one small house, one hut, and he stays there till the storm's going to pass. Now, this guy who lives in the village, he doesn't have too much to offer the king, but whatever he's got, he offers the king. Now, what happens if later on he's going to go around and say, you know how much the king loves me? He spent 4 nights in my house. People will laugh at him. They'll say, what are you talking about? He was stuck in a snowstorm. He stayed by you. It's not like he loves you. That's no big shmeal. So he stayed by you. You want to prove that he loves you? Let's see that he stays with you when he has all the options in the world. If he still stays in your house, then we'll believe it. That's what the pasuk's saying. The true rejoicing of Zion will be when Hashem rests in our midst. And maybe you'll say that the only reason God is with us is because He has no choice. Like we said earlier, there is that point where God says, I have no choice. So the prophet says, no. That's a continuation of the verse. Many nations will follow God in the future. There will come a time when the nations will realize this is the way to go. And then God will have other options. And that's why the pasuk repeats, and even then, I will choose you. I will rest in your midst. And that's the great proof that Zechariah says, you'll know that I'm a true prophet. The nations will come and they'll also want God to be with them. God will say at that point, no, they're my people. Now back to our story. Why is it that the Megillah stresses on the seventh day Achashverosh was satiated with wine? It's reminding us of that seventh day that we desecrated. Why is it that we were in trouble because of our seventh day? So the pasuk tells us now how the formula is going to work. The problem and the solution. Remember, the solution is going to grow out of the problem. So the nations are all sitting there and talking. And Chazal tell us that God did a comparison. He said, it's the seventh day, it's Shabbos. My people, Israel, they eat and drink on Shabbos. Achashverosh and his men, They're sitting and feasting on Shabbos. What do? When we eat and drink on Shabbos, we start singing smiros. We sing songs of praise. Libi uvsari yiraninu lekel chai. My flesh and my heart sing in front of Hashem. I yearn for Hashem. What do we say? Look at the words of the songs of Shabbos. Hashem says, let's compare. What are all these Persians talking about? What are Ahasuerus and his men talking about? You know what kind of pornography we have where I come from. You know what type of women we have where I come from. Ahasuerus is boasting his beauty. They're boasting their beauty. Finally, they all say, show us. You bring Vashti with only her crown on, nothing else on. That's what they're talking about. This is what we're talking about. So Hashem says, let's compare. It's Shabbos, right? My people have been desecrating Shabbos in Israel, and that's why I'm going to have to bring a punishment. But look, let's compare. Well, what do they do on their Shabbos? So they're not living up to all the laws of Shabbos. Well, what do they do when they eat and drink on Shabbos? And so even though this very meal is going to be the source of our punishment, this is the beginning of our problems, nonetheless, Hashem says, this is also going to be the source of the solution, because at this very meal, Hashem says, okay, now let's compare. And now we understand, how did we get out of it? We began with the question, if we got this punishment because we were desecrating Shabbos, so then why did Hashem let us get out of the decree? The answer is because of Shabbos itself too. Because Hashem said, okay, so they're not living up to their responsibilities of Shabbos, but let's compare. Where's Ahasuerus when he drinks on Shabbos, and where are they when they drink on Shabbos? They're not 100% on Shabbos. And one of the things I think we're supposed to learn from all of this is the capacity to have a good eye. We think, he's a Berdichever, you know, Rabbi, you guys know the story of the Rebbe of Berdichev? Yeah, he's walking on Shabbos and he sees a Jew smoking. So he says to him, must be you forgot it's Shabbos today. So the Jew says, no, Rabbi, I know it's Shabbos. So he says, must be you didn't know it's prohibited to smoke on Shabbos. She says, no, I know it's prohibited. So Reb Levi Yitzchak Mibarditchev raises his eyes to heaven and he says, God, what a great people you have. Even a guy who purposely desecrates Shabbos will not let a lie come out of his mouth. Look at what great people they are. To see the good. Yeah.
You were talking about always comparing Jewish people with
not always. It's a default. Okay, if we're not so better than that, then we're compared.
To compare with other nations. If other nations didn't have laws we have.
Right.
And our the tenet on Torah is not for us to compare ourselves to other nations. It's for us to be
right. Right. We have to live up to it. Right. Our responsibility is to be much better than that. But when we're not, we have this protective feature, so to speak. But Hashem says, okay, even if they're not so bad. Let's compare them.
So it will be a lawyer?
Well, it's a claim. It's one of the ways Hashem views things, and it's something that protects us. The Pasuk says that he spoke to his 7 eunuchs when his heart was satiated with wine. So the Medrash says, the nations of the world, they don't have it good. As the verse says, the wicked never have it good. So the Medrash says, a question, what do you mean the nations never have it good? Look at the Megillah. It says, the king's heart was good and satiated with wine. Kit tov lev ha-melech bayayin. As good was his heart with wine. So the Medrash answers, it says, kit tov lev ha-melech bayayin. As good. But it wasn't bitov. It wasn't really good. It was as good. This is almost good. But it's not really good. And when we have it good, we have it really good. As the verse says, when we were celebrating the inauguration of the Beis HaMikdash, it says everyone went back to their tent, happy and with a good heart over all the good that God had given them. So Ahasuerus is celebrating because he's destroyed the temple. He hasn't destroyed it, but he's using the temple vessels because he feels that's it, I'm invincible. The 70 years are up, and I could use the temples of the vessel, and the Jews are never going to be redeemed, the Mashiach is never going to come, and my kingdom can last forever. So he's at the golden era of his kingdom, and we're comparing that with the Jews' golden era, when we finally had our temple and peace, and we ruled the world, and Shlomo was king. By Achashverosh it says kitov. By Yasewa it says they went back home tov ve'lev. Their hearts were good. And the question is, what's the Medrash talking about? Is that the indication that the wicked don't have it really good? So the idea can be understood with an introduction. And that introduction is really an understanding of the difference between one who serves Hashem and doesn't. You have one guy who spends his life looking for worldly pleasures. You have another guy who spends his life doing mitzvahs. He leads a moral life. Where do you see the difference between them? You ask them both, how's your life? They both say life's great. When do you start seeing the difference between them? As they age. The tzaddik, who's invested in his life in worthwhile things, even as he sees that his end is nearing, he's not worried. He thinks back and he says, I've led a good life. I have a lot to show for my life. I've produced a lot in the world. And I know that I'm still waiting for a world to come where things are just going to get better based on everything I've done. Then you have the fool who spent his life chasing after all the worldly things. As he sees himself getting weaker, and as he sees that he can no longer run like he once used to be able to, so then he looks at his past, and he doesn't have room to be so happy about it. What's he going to say? I had tremendous steaks. I had tremendous cheeseburgers. I drove a Ferrari. Okay. And now what? Meaning, when a person's focus is on the physical world, his focus can only be on the future. He cannot derive pleasure from his past, because there's nothing to derive pleasure from. He enjoys the moment, he enjoys the thoughts of the future. When he starts seeing that there might not be a future, that's when his joy starts ending. When you have a person who leads a worthwhile life, then his joy is not only in the present and future, it's also in the past, and the accomplishments he could see that he has acquired. So when a person's focus is the future, the worldly pleasures, then as his life proceeds and he's coming close to an end, he starts worrying. Wait a second. Now what? And that's what King Solomon says in Ecclesiastes. If a person would live hundreds of years, I'd still say he's better off having been miscarried. If a person's whole focus is on the future, and he spends his whole life chasing the worldly pleasures, so then a baby that's miscarried is better off in a certain sense, because he's never going to miss anything. What happens when a person's focus is on the worldly pleasures? When he has to stop attaining those worldly pleasures, so then he has a period of tremendous pain. What's life all about? At least the guy who was miscarried doesn't have that. And that's what Yeshaya says. People who are focused on the worldly pleasures, they say, come, let's enjoy the wines, and tomorrow will be even better than today. Because I could only enjoy today fully if I think tomorrow is going to be better. Because my focus is always on the material. Another difference is that being that the tzaddik's happiness is true, and it's internal, and it's with the Torah and the mitzvos, he doesn't need external stimuli to be happy. Quite the contrary. His happiness stems from within himself. He doesn't need drugs. He doesn't need alcohol. He doesn't need any of them. Point aside, the first class I gave for Machon Meir, about 7 or 8 years ago, I came to Rav Listman and I said, I live just behind the Machon. Then I used to live on Herzl. I said, if you ever need someone to give a class, I used to teach before I came to Israel, and I walk by here every night. I walk by. If you ever need someone, let me know. So I offered him once, twice. The third time I came in, he said to me, I have a group of guys here from Bnei Akiva in Europe, and this is their last night here in Israel, and then they're all going off to college. None of them had any taste of Torah before they came, and they had one day in the Machon, and then they have today, and they're only coming to the Machon tonight. We don't have anyone here to teach them. So if you could talk to them, if you could have them over, order pizza, the Machon will cover it, and have them over. Fine, that's quite a doozy, a way to start. These people have 2 days of Judaism in their life. Non-observant families, right? 2 days of Judaism in their life, and I'm supposed to be one of them. You can imagine that the next 2 hours wasn't such calm hours in my life. So that's a long story how it worked out, but at the end, whatever I tried saying to them didn't work. So I said, okay guys, you give me what topics you want to discuss. That was where the question and answer session first began. I said, here's a piece of paper. Each of you write 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, as many topics as you want us to discuss. And we'll take 2 minutes on each topic that you want, what Judaism has to say about it. So what do you think they did to me? They wrote alcohol, wine, drugs, and then a whole bunch of other words which we won't mention in this class. They put every type of material pleasure you could imagine under the sun. And they said, not talk about that, Rabbi. Think about it. Where were they coming from? They wanted to discuss what was fun from their perspective. We ended up discussing how Torah views all of that. That all of that can be used in moderation. It's a tool, but it's not the focus. And the Magid Midubna comes back to us and says, another marked difference between the happiness of a righteous person and the happiness of a person who's chasing the mundane is that a righteous person does not need external things to be happy. He can be happy with life itself. You know who loved life the most in the world? Who is the greatest lover of life? Moshe Rabbeinu. We have maybe 15 pages of discussion between Moshe and God, Moshe arguing, I shouldn't die. We have a whole medrash, about 15 pages long, where Moshe is arguing why he shouldn't die. And God keeps telling him, everyone else does. And Moshe says, yeah, but I'm not like everyone else. And God says, Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov died. And Moshe says, yeah, but I'm better than Avram and this, and I'm better than Yitzchak and that, and I'm better than Yaakov and that. Well, 15 pages, Moshe's arguing back and forth and back and forth and back and forth. Why you shouldn't die. And if you're curious to hear those 15 pages, about 4 or 5 years ago, on Hoshana Rabbah night, we studied those, that medrash together, in preparation for Simchas Torah, Moshe's passing. So we studied that. It's online, should be under special classes in Torah for me. So you have a whole long medrash. Moshe was the greatest lover of life. Why? Because his life meant the most. He valued life. One of the reasons we don't value life is because we're not really living it to the fullest. The more you live life to the fullest, the more your life has value, the more you see what you're doing in life, how much, well, look at what you're accomplishing, look at the mitzvos, look at how valuable it is, look at how great it is to be a servant of Hashem. The more a person connects to that, the more he loves life. A person who doesn't have that focus in life, so then where does he get happiness? He has to use external stimuli. He needs wine. He needs beer. He needs drugs. He needs something to get him high. Because what's there to be happy about in life? He needs music. We use those as tools, but that's not the point. That's not the happiness. What's it similar to? A father and a son come to a feast. And they serve delicious food. And then it's time for the main course. So they bring out a piece of meat, and it's covered with all kinds of great spices. And everyone's salivating as that first piece of meat comes across, and everyone smells the meat, and they put it before the kid's father. And the father says, no thanks, take that away. So the kid looks at his father, and he says, Dad, why? Could you smell that? His father says, yeah, I did, that's why I don't want it. So the son says, but it smelled magnificent. Everyone at the table wants his hand on that piece of meat. He says, let me tell you something. What you smelled were all the spices around. Right? Yeah. Well, they put all those spices because it's really lousy meat. What you're smelling is how they cover up the meat. I was once eating ice cream, and I told my father, you want some chocolate ice cream? I come from a long line of cheese and milk product manufacturers. So my father said, everything but the chocolate. So I said, why not the chocolate? So my father said, because I used to make ice cream. And chocolate is what you do with all the garbage ice cream. Chocolate covers every flavor. You don't know what you're eating when you eat chocolate ice cream. Anytime you have ice cream that went bad, ice cream that, you stick that in the chocolate bin because that covers all the garbage. So that's, give me anything but the chocolate. So I still eat chocolate ice cream. I didn't see the garbage. I just like the taste, right? That's this idea. The prophet in Yeshaya says, woe to those who wake up in the morning searching for beer. Woe to those who are always looking for music and wine and going to the bars. because that's testimony that they don't have real happiness. If they have to find themselves in the bars, then they have to be distracted from life. If they had true internal happiness, they wouldn't need that. And that's like the stinky meat. The meat is rotten, but you need all the spices for it to smell good. Life stinks. How many people will tell you life is terrible? So they need all the external spices. You know who I saw that loved life? About 3 years ago, I tell this story often. There was a person who's today a teacher here at Mechon Meir, whose wife was with terminal cancer. They had no cure. And she was in tremendous pain. And the doctors begged her to put her on morphine. And she said no. And her body was convulsing with pain. And she said no. And I asked her why. Well, and she said, because when I'll be on morphine, I'll be a dope. I'll be totally doped and I won't be living life. And you know what? I wake up in the morning and I smell the beautiful air Hashem gave us. I can talk to my children and educate them. You remember I told you guys the story when I went with them to the doctor in Tel Aviv and I got car sick. And I said, I can't. On the way back, they wanted to go see the sea. And I said, I can't. And then I thought there was something romantic about it. And she said, no, I wanted to make one more blessing in my life. When you see the sea, you make a blessing. Yeah, that's a person that loves life. Till her last moment, she wouldn't take morphine. Until she was out, then they put her on morphine. Because she loved life. That's great people. Their happiness says she didn't need the external stimuli. Quite the contrary. She loved life so much that she didn't want to lose a moment of life, even if it meant under great suffering. The Navi laments, woe to those people who need the external stimuli. And that's what we find by Esther. Esther is described as being beautiful to all who saw her. The other women weren't beautiful? What do you mean? Ahasuerus is having a pageant. The other women needed jewelry and makeup and everything else. They didn't have their own beauty. Esther wasn't interested in Ahasuerus. She wasn't putting on beauty, makeup or jewelry or anything else, but she had natural beauty. That's what the pasuk stresses. She found favor in everyone else's eyes. Everyone else had the other tools. You have two merchants. And very often you see these two merchants in your life. One of them takes loans and he borrows wares from other merchants. And then he goes to the big fair. And 80% of his goods he still owes to the bank. 20% is his. The other merchant doesn't take any loans. But everything he's selling is his. And every day when these two merchants sit down for coffee at the end of the day, the merchant who took 80% on loan keeps boasting, you know how many sales I made today? You know how many wares I have here? And he keeps talking and talking and talking, and you know, you don't come close to me. And day after day, the other merchant is silent. Until finally, one day he's had it, and he tells him, you know, you're a fake. Everything you own isn't yours. What do you mean? You owe the bank and you owe interest, and by the time you're finished, you're going to have so little money left when we get back home. You owe everyone for everything you own. So what? You're not selling your own goods. You're working for everyone else. By me, everything I sell, at least I know it's mine. I don't have debts. That's what I think it's a big problem. It's a disease here in Israel. Everyone lives in minus. How could you live in minus? You're working your head off to pay the bank their interest. You barely ever get out of the loan. How could you do that? I don't know what's in America. Maybe today it's worse in America. Here it's like a given and shouldn't be a given. One of the things my wife and I agreed on is that before we got married, that we wouldn't open a bank account that has capacity for minus. No such capacity. I got to make sure a check doesn't bounce, but I also got to make sure I don't enter minus, right? So there is no such capacity. I don't think I have a single bank account that has that capacity. I don't want it. Okay, fine. So Shlomo HaMelech says, Sheker achen behevel ayofi, isha yirat Hashem ititala. Chen is a lie, beauty is vanity, the fear of Hashem is what's praiseworthy. You could create chen with gold and silver and jewelry and perfume. So there's sheker involved there. But Yirat Hashem, that's something you can't forge. There's no forging Yirat Hashem. And that stems from the woman herself. And that's why it says, He Titalal. That's when you praise the person themselves. No external stimuli. The person himself can be praised. Chain and Yofi? No. There are mascaras, there are facelifts, there are a million ways you can forge that. And that's what the Jewish people say before Hashem, Ani Chavatzelet HaSharon. It is I, the Jewish people say, and you love me. Meaning, I don't need anything to show my beauty other than myself. The nations all around, they have castles, they have twin towers, they have heirlooms. Hey, look at the nations. They have things that they pass down from generation to generation. What do I have? I don't have anything from my great-grandfather. I don't have anything from 10 generations ago. I can't. We've been chased all around the world. How could I have something that stays in the family for 10 generations? What could stay in the family for 10 generations? But our chen, the Jewish people say to God, is the people who learn Torah out of poverty. Who we are is our chen. And that's true chen, and that's what the Jewish people say before God. I have chen. They have wealth. They have external things that make them impressive. We don't have a Golden Gate Bridge here in Israel. We don't have a Statue of Liberty. We don't have all that. What do we have? We have who we are. The stones here in Israel are steeped in tradition. And that's what the commandment is to Aaron. When you come into the temple, you may not drink wine. Because you should be elevated by the fact that you're entering the temple. How could you drink wine? What do you need wine for? You're coming close to Hashem, you're drinking wine? What for? And that's the discussion of the false flame, the foreign flame that Aaron's children lit when they walked in and they were consumed by God's fire. So Rabbi Yishmael says, what was a foreign flame? That was a foreign flame that burned within them, that they walked in drunk, they walked in after drinking. And that was God's claim. You guys can't be happy enough without wine? Serving me isn't enough? You guys made it to serve in the holy and you can't, that's not enough? What's this similar to? A guy brings up his niece who's orphaned and he gives her everything she needs. And then the time comes for her to get married and he gives her everything. And he finds her a good shidduch, the son of the wealthy baron in the next town, and they date and he likes her and she likes him and everything's great and they get married. And it happens that they have a little fight, but this little fight evolves, and the husband decides, that's it, I've had it. So he's so upset with her that he sends word to the scribe in the next town where her uncle lives. He sends word that he wants him to come and write a get. Finished. The woman, she understands what's afoot, so she sends a messenger to that same town. And she says, Uncle, I need you here. You got to talk to my husband, talk some sense into him. So, 2 days later, the messengers get to the next town. The scribe gets all ready to travel over there to write a get. The uncle here gets the letter. He gets all ready, and he's traveling there to save the marriage. He's leaving the city with his horse and buggy, and there's the scribe trying to hitch a ride. The scribe says, which town are you going to? He tells him the town. He says, I got to go there to write a get. I just got a letter. It's very important. I got to go. So the uncle tells him, look, buddy, you want a ride? I'll give you a ride. But I'm telling you that you got no work there. You better go home and wait for another get. Because when I get to that town, I'm going to take care of that marriage. There won't be any get. So you better stay home. Everything's going to be okay. What's this similar to? Why did God create wine? To make a person happy, sometimes to uplift a person's spirit. But it doesn't belong here in Jerusalem. It doesn't belong by the temple. Because when you have a temple, so then there's no divorce coming. You don't need the scribe. It doesn't belong there. Everything's going to be worked out without it. A Kohen who's going to serve Hashem shouldn't need it. He should be happy without it. Things should be right within him. The happiness should be within him without it. So a person who's focused on the physical needs external stimuli for happiness. A person who's internally strong, who's led a productive life, doesn't need it. Now let's go back to the original Medrash. The Medrash says, Achashverosh kitov lev ha-melech bayayin. As his heart was good with wine. You guys see where we're headed? As it's good with wine. The Medrash says, the wicked never have it good in this world. The Medrash asks, what do you mean they don't have it good? Achashverosh, it says it was good with wine. The Medrash says, no. As good with wine. He didn't have full happiness. What did he need the wine for? Shlomo HaMelech, the Pasuk says, the nation left the party, they all came home, and things were good and happy. The stress is, what's a person like the morning after the party? The Jewish people, the Pasuk stresses, after they had the inauguration of the Beit HaMikdash, they went home and it was good. That's what the Midrash says. That's good. That's because the good is not focused on the material. It's not focused on the future. Achashverosh's good was a material good. He has the wealth, he has the party, he has the wife, he has the wine. Now it's as it's good with wine. So the Midrash says that's not good. Good is when you leave the party and you're still leaving a glow. You're leaving even happier and even better. Ah, that's when you build the Beis HaMikdash. That's when you've done something that has real value to it. And that's the comparison that the Midrash is saying. We use wine as a tool, but really we're focused on the essence of life, and the others use wine in order to forget life, and that is the essence of the happiness. It's two different uses of wine. We'll pick up here, Bezalel Hashem, next week.